I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Jonna Schwartz. She is a professor of human development at the University of California, Davis, where she researches how environmental and genetic factors influence adolescent brain development and mental health. Dr. Schwartz, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you for coming. So Dr. Schwartz, how did you first become interested in developmental psychology and neuroscience? And you can go back as far as you can.
As far as I can, well, from birth, no, I'm just kidding. So, so from undergrad, my undergrad degree was psychology. I went to Tufts University, which is a somewhat small liberal arts school in Massachusetts. And so I was just always really fascinated by psychology, kind of like every aspect. I think every psych course I took, I was just like, wow, this is super interesting. And I think just understanding why people do the things they do and why they behave that way is in any ways is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I got involved in research. I hadn't thought about research at all as a career path. But because Tufts was so small, one of the nice things about that was we had really small classes. So you really got to like know your professors really well as a student. So in my intro to developmental psychology class, which I was taking for my psych major, the professor in that reached out to me at the end of the class. And I guess, you know, I had shown a lot of enthusiasm for the topic. And she asked, would you be interested in getting involved in research? And I never thought about it, but I was like, sure, that sounds cool. I'll give that a try. And she connected me with her colleague in the psych department, Holly Taylor, who was looking for an undergrad research assistant. So that's kind of how I got involved. I hadn't really thought of it on my own at all. And it was just kind of a mentor stepping in and kind of guiding me. And then, so I worked in Holly Taylor's lab as an undergrad research assistant doing something completely different than I do now. So she does spatial cognition, which is looking at essentially kind of how we navigate like maps and space, how we form mental maps, like how do you like, you know, when you drive a route, how do you decide on the route and make that mental map and navigate that, which was really interesting, but I knew not what I wanted to do long-term. So when I told her that I was interested in going to grad school and doing more research, but I really wanted to focus on mental health, because mental health is just something that's always interested me. And I think can have a big impact on, you know, benefiting society if you find some way to treat a mental health problem or prevent it or understand just more about what causes it, that could have, you know, benefits for, you know, hundreds and thousands and potentially more people. So I told her I really wanted to kind of focus on mental health for that. So she connected me with another colleague in the psych department at Tufts, Lisa Shin. And Lisa Shin does neuroimaging research to look at brain correlates of post-traumatic stress disorder. So she mostly images like veterans of wars and looks at why do some veterans develop PTSD after exposure to trauma and combat, whereas others don't. And we look at brain regions that help us determine, you know, who's maybe at higher risk or why some people are more likely to develop PTSD than others. So I then volunteered in her lab and started doing the MRI scanning. And that's where I got interested in neuroscience, was from working with her. And I, again, never thought about MRI scanning or neuroscience until I got connected with that mentor. So that was kind of my growing interest in neuroscience and mental health. And then when I applied to grad schools, I decided to go to University of Michigan, and my mentor there was Christopher Monk, and he did neuroimaging research on adolescents with a focus on both anxiety disorders and autism spectrum disorder. So carrying that thread of anxiety and mental health into grad school. And that's kind of when I got into more developmental neuroscience, thinking about teens' brains, and thinking about, you know, these mental health problems while they're developing or even before they develop, and thinking of more of kind of preventive approach. So being in the developmental psychology program at University of Michigan kind of sparked that interest in adolescent brain development. And I think it's a really interesting time to study the brain because it's so kind of plastic, we say, and open to influences, more so than potentially at later stages of life, like, you know, in your 30s or 40s or in adulthood, there's less plasticity there. So it's, some have described it as this window of opportunity where if you could, you know, get great experiences and interventions in for teens, you could really kind of change their lives for the better and put them on positive trajectories. But if there's a lot of stress and negative things happening in that the teenage period, then because the brain is so open and plastic to experiences, you're potentially, you know, laying them more on a foundation or a trajectory for more negative health, mental health outcomes. So it's kind of this interesting period where there's a lot of possibility for good or bad things to happen. And so that was kind of how I got interested in the adolescent brain. And then I did my postdoc at Duke University working with Ahmad Hariri, and I worked on a data set there where we had adolescents who were at risk for depression because they had one or more parents who had a history of depression. So again, looking more at that like risk perspective, and can we catch things early on before you have this really serious, you know, mental health problem that's now harder to treat. And so we looked at kind of brain markers that were differentiating adolescents who were at high risk because they had a parent with depression and adolescents who were lower risk because they didn't have a parent with depression, and looking for differences in their brain development. So I'd say my story is just a lot of like mentors kind of finding me and then opening opportunities and then connecting me to other opportunities, and just through those different connections kind of shaping my current research and interests. Uh-huh.
It seems like that's a really common path, because I guess most people don't start off as teenagers and they have like a research plan in mind or even know what research is. But it is interesting that your story started like basically as an adult. I mean, I know the brain is still developing into your 20s, but it's like, what went on during those first 18 years that brought you onto this path?
I think, you know, I was highly motivated in school, I think. You know, that was a factor. I just really enjoyed learning. And I think that feeds into the research component. Like, I love learning new things, like kind of posing research questions and thinking creatively about problems. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of like doing something helpful and productive for society. And for me, that was kind of through research and maybe researching a problem that, you know, you could bring new solutions to. So I think it was just a lot of positive encouragement from teachers and my parents and friends. You know, like I talked about, if you get a lot of positive influences during adolescence, it can really push you on that positive trajectory where you're really highly motivated to work hard and contribute positively.
Yeah, that's a good tie into your current research. I know you don't do much research on personality, but it brings to mind the same questions, like how much of that is also influenced by your genetics or your upbringing, and then how does that shape your career choices and your interests and all that stuff?
Yeah, we talk about that. I actually teach a class called Social and Personality Development for our human development major. So we talk about this nature and nurture question quite a bit in terms of, for especially for personality, since it's about personality development, how much is it your genes are shaping your personality versus your experiences. And of course, I think most people right now would say it's the interplay between the two, that there are clearly genetic influences on personality, but that's not the whole story. There's clearly a lot of environmental, social influences on personality as well. So we talk a lot about that in my class.
In your early education, were you already drawn to the biological side, or did that come later once you got involved in your neuro research?
I think, like I said, I was just interested in everything. So I really could have gone in like 10 different directions and been happy in any one, because so much of psychology is interesting. And this still happens to this day where I learn about like a new, like a, you know, mini new niche field of research. And I'm like, wow, that's super interesting. Like, I wish I was studying like, you know, whatever random topic. I was like, that's so cool. So yeah, this happens all the time where I'm like, oh, there's just like so much interesting stuff to study. I really could have probably been happy doing like 10 different lines of research. And it was just a little bit of chance of like falling in with a lab that did neuroimaging and then getting into a grad school lab that did more neuroimaging. And the thing that happens with that is it's such a highly developed skill. Like, it takes a really long time to learn MRI and coding and the analysis of MRI, that like once you've developed that skill, you want to like keep applying it and using it. I think it was a little bit random chance, but then also just finding it interesting and continuing on that path once I discovered it.
Yeah. And in terms of the application, especially for neuroscience, I noticed that some people seem to be more like, you know, they focus a lot on brain health and like, how can we make a positive impact with this research? And then for others, it's more like, you know, it's a huge mystery and we just want to understand it and mm-hmm. I guess less focused on the practical benefits. So it sounds like from this explanation, you're very interested in learning, but then also the nature of your work is it seems like more practical than like studying, you know, more abstract things like belief or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think like you said, it's both. Like, I think it's just really interesting to know, but then at the same time, it's also nice that your research could, you know, make some contribution in terms of practical benefits. And, you know, for neuroimaging research, that might not be like a direct application because there aren't, you know, necessarily a lot of treatments that are tied to neuroimaging, although there are some, like there's treatments where you kind of train people with an MRI scan to gain better control over parts of their brain. But just kind of contributing that little piece of the puzzle, and then somebody can take that and, you know, make another connection and through that just be a part of kind of improving treatment or prevention in some way. So yeah, I would definitely want my research to have some sort of practical benefit as well.
So what did you do after your postdoc?
After my postdoc, I started here at UC Davis. So I did 3 years of the postdoc at Duke and then moved out here to Davis, California. And I'm in the Department of Human Ecology. So our major is human development. So I kind of started, you know, as an assistant professor and getting my lab up and running and, you know, designing studies and writing grants and all that fun stuff you get to do as an assistant professor. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So from that point on, you kind of get to shape your own research questions more so than when you're a student or even a postdoc, right?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something kind of especially true for neuroimaging researchers, because our research is so expensive. it's pretty uncommon for a grad student or even a postdoc to like design and run their own fMRI study, just because it's difficult to get the amount of funding you would need to. You might be able to do like a pilot study on like a small number, like 10 participants, but to get enough funding to scan, you know, 100 or more participants, it's unusual for like there to be grants that are that large for grad students and postdocs. So you're typically in a grad student or postdoc role, you're analyzing a data set that was, the study was designed by your mentor, and you're just analyzing the data. And you can take that and analyze it in different ways and answer questions that are interesting to you, but you typically, you know, weren't the one that really like did the majority of the design. So when you do become an assistant professor, you do get, you know, the startup funding and the bigger grants that allow you to kind of take more direction and design your own research.
Mm-hmm. And then even within a single lab, when a study that's run by a PI is comparatively smaller to something like a national study, like the ABCD study. So that's like nationally funded and has a whole bunch of contributing universities and professors and like tens of thousands of participants, right?
Yeah.
So could we talk about the pros and cons between like those giant studies that are probably more well-designed, but also I guess the con is you can't explore, like you can't personally tailor it as much, your questions?
Yeah, that's exactly the pros and cons. So if you are designing your own study, you can, you know, you have complete control over the measures you collect, the MRI tasks that are used. So with MRI, especially if we're interested in looking at brain activation associated with a specific behavior or emotion, we're going to have participants do a task in the scanner. Where they're going to look at faces or look at, you know, or gain rewards or do something that's going to activate the part of the brain we're interested in. But if you're using a data set that, you know, is a national data set, you don't get to specify which tasks, you know, that they're using or which, you know, psychological processes that they're tapping. The other potential downside of the large data sets is because they often are designed to try to address as many questions as possible, often the individual measures themselves tend to be shorter and potentially kind of not as detailed as you might like for your specific topic. So sometimes even there will be like one question about, you know, whatever variable or concept you're interested in. And most researchers would agree you want to ask multiple questions to kind of, you know, get a better sense of of anxiety or depression. That's, you know, the potential downside is that you're you know, maybe not getting the best measures or the best possible task for your specific research question, but you are getting this huge sample size and usually a lot more diversity in terms of the participants that are recruited. So it is a trade-off. And I think probably the, you know, the ideal way to do it might be, test something in the large data set, see if that effect is there, and then maybe you could follow it up with a study you design to get kind of more fine-grained detail if the first one shows that that effect that you're thinking, you know, seems to be looking good or there's some promise there.
Mm-hmm. Throughout your career, have you found like a sweet spot of maybe the number of participants you like working with or the type of study you like to design?
Ooh, a sweet spot. I think it's, again, pros and cons. I think I definitely have a preference for studies that are at least on the larger side, like 100 or more. For a while, it was really common to see studies with like 20 or 30 participants, which is just pretty small. Sometimes I just don't, you know, trust that effect found in like 30 participants would hold up. And 100 is actually really small as well, but I, you know, trust a little bit more. If you see like a signal there, a pattern there, then you can follow that up in a larger data set. The large ones I think are great. I think you just then get into like data processing demands where you're working with like 10,000 people's MRI data, and you know, where is that stored, and the computer processing needed to process some of that data and manage it can get quite intense. So I think there are some challenges to those larger data sets, but they're worth it in terms of getting your larger sample size. So I haven't worked with the ABCD data set yet. We actually, I'm a co-investigator on a grant where we're going to work on this. So I'll have a little bit more experience with it over the next couple of years while we're working on those analyses. But yeah, I can say even working on the Duke neurogenetic study, which was my postdoc mentor's study at Duke, I think that had over 1,000 participants. It was great because you had this huge sample size. You could look at like, you know, interaction analyses. You could split participants and look at sex differences because it was like adequately powered to look at sex differences. So it was really fantastic. But then you do have these large sample sizes, so it does get sometimes more difficult to analyze. But again, the benefits kind of outweigh those cons, I think.
Yeah. So how much of your research tends to be sort of exploratory, where it's like you're testing something and you're just looking to see where the brain lights up, versus it's like maybe you know some effect exists and you're trying to refine it?
I would say probably right now, at least, the majority of my research is, I would classify it in the exploratory realm. So for different reasons, we're either, you know, looking at a set of variables that haven't been looked at before, or in another line of research right now, we're conducting research in Brazil, in adolescents in Brazil. And that's just largely exploratory because we have no idea, like not much imaging research has been conducted outside of high income countries like the US. So we just don't really know what the differences there are in other countries. So I'd classify that as exploratory, as a first look to just see what the differences are. I think maybe later in my career, I could see moving into the like confirmatory phase where I've, you know, had all these exploratory effects from these initial studies. And then we might design bigger and larger, more cross-cultural comparison studies to confirm those effects. But I think especially like starting out, being within, I think, the first 5 years of being a professor, it feels much more like exploratory. And I've had all these ideas I wanted to test, and like now I'm testing them, but it's all the first time. So So everything is kind of take it with a grain of salt until we replicate it in another sample.
Yeah. Well, even if they're not replicated yet, let's talk about what you found in your first 5 years of research here.
So I have a couple different kind of directions of research. So I mentioned is the study in Brazil, we can talk about that first, and then my other one is the study I designed here at Davis. The study in Brazil was, it's a collaboration with kind of a range of different colleagues. We call it the IDEA collaboration, which stands for Identifying Depression Early in Adolescence. So these are collaborators kind of across the globe in Brazil and London and in kind of many different countries. And our goal is to just kind of identify, you know, depression early in adolescence, so better understand depression risk and how to prevent it. So this study is really interesting because it was kind of spearheaded by my collaborator, Christian Keeling, in Brazil. And what they did was they developed this risk score for calculating somebody's risk for depression. And we know, you know, there are a number of risk factors for depression. We know that family history of depression, I mentioned, is a big one. So if you have a parent or a first degree relative with a history of depression, you're at higher risk. But we know there are other risk factors like poverty, child maltreatment, bullying or being rejected by peers, not doing well in school, you know, being expelled from school or failing out of school. And so what they did was they took a number of these risk factors and combined them into a risk score, which had really not been done much previously. A lot of the early risk work kind of with some of these variables, at least with the brain, looked at them separately. So let's look at this one risk factor and its effect on the brain, you know, rather than combining them. So they created this risk score based on a previous sample collected in Brazil. And it kind of, you know, give the adolescents a questionnaire. I think it has 11 risk items, I believe. So you ask them, you know, like, were you ever expelled from school? And, you know, do you feel isolated from your peers? I can't remember the exact questions. But so you ask them these questions, yes or no questions, you get their responses. Essentially, you can put that into the calculator and get like a percentage of risk in terms of their estimated risk for developing depression in the next 3 years. And so that's kind of cool on its own to be developing these measures to try to more adequately classify someone's risk. Mm-hmm. So can we get like a more precise estimate of someone's risk so we can really make sure we're targeting preventions towards those really high risk teens? But on top of that, my contribution to the study is we're doing neuroimaging with the adolescents in Brazil. So we're looking at how does exposure to all of these risk factors, you know, affect brain function in the adolescents? And we just got a grant to follow them over time. So we're starting to follow them again, and we're gonna look at how this predicts changes in the brain over time. And again, can we see those patterns emerge early on that then predicts who's gonna develop depression, you know, when they're 18? So that's the goal of that research. We're still doing the longitudinal follow-ups. So we don't have any findings from that. Uh-huh. We do have findings from the baseline where we conducted it when they were 14 to 16 years old. And we have one paper published from that so far, which was, so one of our questions was, do the risk markers that we find in adolescents in high income countries like the US that are tied to depression risk, do we also find those same risk markers in the brain in adolescents in Brazil? So, you know, completely different country, different culture, different set of socioeconomic circumstances and stressors. And we thought it could go either way because it's brain function, right? So it's biology. So maybe we'll see that it, you know, it's universal and it looks, you know, very similar across different countries and cultures. But there, we know there's lots of cultural influences on our biology and brain function. So maybe we'll see differences. And kind of the short answer to that is we kind of saw both. So we saw some patterns of brain activity that were unique to risk in Brazil that we haven't seen in American adolescents or adolescents from high income countries. We saw one pattern of brain activity that was very similar to what has been found in American adolescents or adolescents from other high income countries. And that was that reduced connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala was associated with higher depression symptoms in these high-risk adolescents. And we know, so that's a finding that has been shown in high-income countries like the US. That's a pretty consistent finding. And the prefrontal cortex and amygdala circuit, these two brain regions are connected. And it's kind of thought of as an emotion regulation circuit. So the amygdala is kind of our threat detector. So it's the, you know, they say it's like the guard dog that's kind of watching out for signs of an intruder in the house. And if it hears something, it'll kind of sound the alarm and tell the other parts of the brain to prepare for a threat or, you know, to respond to the stressor. So the amygdala kind of activates the stress response. So it's on the alert for signs of threat. If it detects something that's potentially threatening or stressful, it'll kind of, you know, activate your stress response. The prefrontal cortex regulates the amygdala. So, you know, it'll look out and it'll see like, oh, that was just the wind. And it'll say like, you know, be quiet, dog. Like it's not a real threat. Like we're okay. So it can kind of send signals to regulate the amygdala and lower its activity if you're in a safe context, you know, if you know that you shouldn't be stressed out and that you're safe. So we think that that lower connectivity between those two regions could suggest possibly reduced kind of emotion regulation ability, that the prefrontal cortex is maybe not communicating as well with the amygdala. And then, so the amygdala is kind of hyperactive and maybe overly responding to every negative thing that happens to you, even if it's, you know, a more minor thing that happens. Like, you know, you get one bad grade and you're like, oh, my life is ruined. It's over. So that's you know, something we have to continue to test and work that out. But that's kind of one hypothesis of what we're seeing there with why that's associated with depression symptoms.
So the thought is that for depression, the stress signals are pretty much always the same, but it's that they're less able to kind of mute them.
Yeah, exactly. Because they're less able to mute them, you might actually get stronger stress signals over time. So, you know, often stress kind of perpetuates more stress. So if you're not getting the signals to regulate and turn off that stress response, then it can grow kind of even more reactive over development. So that's, yeah, one hypothesis for how that works. And then it might make you more sensitive, again, to like any stressor that it occurs.
And that was the finding that was more universal, or was that unique to the cultures?
That was the finding that was more universal, in that research studies in like American adolescents have also shown that effect, that adolescents with depression also have this reduced amygdala prefrontal cortex connectivity. And we see that in anxiety as well. We think anxiety and depression probably share some common kind of brain pathways. And that seems to be one where the amygdala is just less regulated in anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the things you saw that differed cross-culturally?
Yeah, so one finding, so we had the adolescents perform a couple different tasks during the MRI scan. So the connectivity finding with amygdala and prefrontal cortex, they were doing an emotional face matching task where they had to look at unpleasant emotional faces that were like angry with them, or like frowning, or sad, or fearful. And so in the other task we had them do, it was a gambling task where they won or lost money. And this is a task that's often used to tap the reward centers of the brain. So the ones that light up when you win something, or the ones that tell you when you lost something and are like, oh, I lost something. So with that task, we found that for the adolescents who were either depressed, I guess I didn't mention, we also had a third group of adolescents who were actually actively depressed. Then we had the ones who were at risk but not currently depressed, and then the ones who were low risk and not depressed. Mm-hmm. So for both the high risk and the depressed adolescents, they showed reduced prefrontal cortex activity during that gambling task when winning money. And we know, so the prefrontal cortex does a range of things. One of them is regulating the amygdala. Another thing it does is kind of integrate all the signals and information it's getting from other parts of the brain, and then helps us kind of consciously decide on our behavior. So it also integrates signals about reward and what behavior you're doing is getting rewarded, and, you know, usually telling you to do more of that behavior. So we think that reduced prefrontal cortex activity in those high-risk and depressed adolescents could potentially lead to decreased motivation, which is kind of a cardinal symptom of depression. So one of the key symptoms is this lack of motivation and not finding things rewarding that you would typically find rewarding before you were depressed. And interestingly, we have not found that effect in high-income countries in like American adolescents. They show often reduced activity in the ventral striatum, which is another part of the reward circuit, but more of the kind of basic part that just responds to like, did I receive a reward? Did I not receive a reward? So, yeah.
Uh-huh. So how can we interpret those differences? Do you have anything yet?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that was not an effect we expected to find. We expected to find the blunted ventral striatum activity that we had found in high-income samples. So because it's a surprise effect, we don't have, you know, very strong interpretation yet. My one caution is that, you know, we had some methods differences with this study. One of the big ones was the way we calculated the risk score and who we got into the study. So, you know, previous research on depression hasn't used this exact risk score. It hasn't even really assessed risk. It's just gotten depressed individuals, whether or not they're at high risk. And, you know, there were little differences in our tasks, you know, across, and we have a different MRI scanner. We have the one that's being used in Brazil. So there are differences in the methods that could be driving these different effects we're seeing. So one possibility is just that it's differences in the methods. And I think the only way to address that is to do a true kind of cross-cultural comparison where you have the same exact criteria for the participants, you use the same exact risk score, the same exact task with the same exact parameters, you know, as much as possible, kind of making it equal across the two sites, like American or Brazil or wherever. And then you can really compare and like more strongly say like, these differences must be due to the culture because everything else about the methods were exactly the same. And we can't say that about our study because a lot of our methods were different from prior research. So one possibility is just differences in the methodology. The other is that there are kind of these true cultural differences in the brain pathways of depression. And it's possible those are driven by the different contexts, you know, in Brazil. So, you know, poverty rates are much higher. So money might have a different value or be processed differently in the brain potentially when you're in a, you know, that context. So there's a possible kind of contextual difference there in terms of the brain pathways of depression risks, but we can't kind of say which one it is yet. So, but I think it lays the groundwork for doing that big cross-cultural study. And interestingly, a lot of reviewers, when we wrote the grant to do the follow-up, were like, why would we think it would be any different in Brazilian adolescents? It's like the brain. And we said, well, we don't know. We have to look. So I think this is the first evidence that there could be differences and maybe provides justification for doing that larger cross-cultural study so that you can more closely compare.
Okay, yeah. So fair warning, this is more like speculation, evolutionary psychology stuff. But have you heard of those ideas about how depression is becoming more common because like we're just so used to comfort? So any minor thing bothers us more versus when you're living, I guess, as our ancestors were, you'd be more resilient, I guess. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't read a ton on it, so I don't think I have very strong opinions. I think it could make sense that you know, there's a lot of like kind of evidence that because like our physiological stress systems have kind of been co-opted by daily stressors like traffic and like, you know, like dealing issues with coworkers and like angry emails or, you know, these kind of daily occurrences. But what's interesting is they kind of activate the stress response the same way that, you know, an actual physical threat would. And so they are like the evolutionary psychologists often give the example of the saber-toothed tiger, and our ancestors would see the saber-toothed tiger and that would activate the stress response and you'd have blood pumping through your body and you'd release glucose to get energy and you'd start breathing faster and that would give you the resources you need to fight off that saber-toothed tiger. But when that system is being activated kind of on a daily basis by all these smaller stressors, that's probably not a good thing. Like back, you know, back when there was a saber-toothed tiger, that was a really, really helpful kind of adaptive response to help you survive and fight off that tiger. But it's not a helpful response to have your blood pumping every time you're stuck in traffic or every time you get an angry email from a coworker. And so this kind of chronic day-to-day activation of this stress system that's really meant more for these physical threats that our ancestors were facing, I think there's a lot of evidence that that causes a lot of health problems and probably contributes to anxiety and depression as well. I don't think the answer is like we should all just have lots of physical threats in our environment to fight off, but I think it does suggest that we have to kind of think about how these things are activating the stress response and if there are ways that we can get kind of better control over it so it's not kind of activating it all the time.
Yeah, because depression rates in the US and I guess probably in other places too, are still on the rise, especially with young people. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, I think even more so right now during the COVID-19 pandemic, I've you know, read lots of research suggesting that anxiety and depression rates are up in adults and adolescents, college students in particular, I've seen. So I think if anything, the pandemic has probably made this worse. I think it was increasing before the pandemic, but I think we've definitely seen a jump due to the pandemic.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. I'm more interested in the increase outside of the pandemic because like, you know, the pandemic makes more sense. The other stuff, it seems like when we have all this great technology and like so much abundance and things seem to be getting better, but mental health is getting worse. That's the weirder part. I mean, some people say something like, maybe it was always there and people are just more open and aware of it. But then other people say, like, no, there's something getting worse. Maybe it's our diet. Maybe it's our lack of exercise. Maybe it's all these other risk factors.
Yeah, I think it could be all those things. The other big story for adolescents, because this had been picked up for teens in particular, that there were increasing rates of depression in teens in the U.S., mm-hmm. Especially are the studies I've read, and potentially kind of more so in that age group than in other age groups, like adults. Mm-hmm. And so one of the big hypotheses there is kind of smartphones and Facebook and social media and mm-hmm. just that constant kind of social comparison, potential new avenue for cyberbullying, bullying that can occur at any time of the day, you know, like or night, whether you're at school or not. So there's kind of no end to it the way like, you know, bullying is really harmful as well, in-person bullying, but at least it stops when you leave school and go home, whereas, you know, cyberbullying can occur, you know, through your phone at any time. And likes and gossip and rumors spreading over social media. And there's just kind of all of these new social stressors for teens today that like not even I had to deal with when I was a teenager. Facebook didn't exist. So that's been kind of a big culprit and one of the things that's been pointed at. I think the other factor that's been looked at is increasing competition to like academic competition to get into colleges, increasing competition for high-paying jobs, kind of the lack of high-paying jobs. So that's a big stressor. I mean, I think a big stressor for my generation and the ones that will come after me is housing and being able to afford housing. So I think in some ways we live in a time of abundance and, you know, access to technology and things that make life great. And then I think in other areas, things are getting worse, like with the social media and lack of affordable housing and income inequality. So I don't actually think that everything has gotten better for uh-huh. us. And I think some of those factors could potentially explain some of the increases in depression and anxiety that we see.
Yeah. So going back to the risk factors of depression you were studying, some of them are very like obvious and concrete, like the family history and mm-hmm. maybe chronic illness and poverty and stuff like that. But then are you also considering these more abstract things as risk factors, like the technology use or the academic pressure and stuff like that?
Yeah, so we actually haven't really directly looked at that in any of our research. I think for the risk score that I mentioned in Brazil, we had more of like kind of the direct like stressors, like bullying or you know, failing out of school or things like that. I guess we kind of have like academic competition through that. But in my study at UC Davis, where we were looking at American adolescents, we haven't done as much analysis on that data set yet, but we did look at, again, more kind of direct stressors like bullying, cyberbullying, things like that. So I think that's that kind of question, looking at like these societal trends, is well suited to something like the ABCD data set or somewhere where you kind of have these like national comparisons and you can compare like in regions that have more or less income inequality or affordable housing or whatever you want to look at. Like then you can really see this big picture of how that compares across different regions of the country. So we have talked about kind of looking at those trends in the ABC data set. We have not written that grant yet because we've been working on other ones, but I think that's like a great example of how those national data sets could be used, because you can't do that type of comparison with just like one city in one state.
Yeah, so that sounds like the emerging field of environmental neuroscience. And I've spoken with two people I work with at USC who kind of do some of that research. So they look at these broader impacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've heard it called population neuroscience as well, mm-hmm. where because, you know, traditionally in the past, like you did have these studies that were just in one city, you know, in with one, you know, population really. And so this idea that if you can scan thousands of people and they're representative of the U.S. population, like now you can ask all these questions that you couldn't ask with just these, you know, this group of 100 participants from this one city, from this one state. So I think that also speaks to the promise of those national data sets.
Uh-huh. So you mentioned brain development being this very plastic and important time, but why did you specifically decide to focus on adolescents and not younger children or babies?
Yeah, I think, well, one reason is MRI. So the limits of our methods. you can scan babies in an MRI scanner. You can't have them do tasks for obvious reasons because they're babies. So you can do what's called resting state where you just kind of have them sleep in the scanner. But you are a little bit more limited in terms of the MRI approaches you can use in a baby or even a young child. I think young children would be even more difficult to scan because one of the methodological limitations of MRI is you have to stay very still in this tube essentially with the MRI scanner. And that's hard for adults to do. Like we throw out adult data because they moved too much. So asking like a 4-year-old or 5-year-old child to lie still while we're, you know, collecting pictures of their brain in this kind of scary tube, I think that would be challenging. I know there are people that do that. And I think that's super impressive. I did not want to deal with that. So part of it is just the method and you can get teens to go in a scanner and lie still and perform tasks. And the benefit of that is then you do get the tasks. I think the other reason for looking at adolescents, the more like conceptual reason, is that a lot of the things we're looking at, particularly depression, emerge around this time. And they probably have antecedents in infancy and early childhood. But if you want to look at like right when depression is starting to show up for the first time, adolescence is an obvious time to look at it. And there is childhood depression, but it's much more rare. So children can get depression, but you don't see it that frequently. Whereas you see depression emerge much more commonly in adolescence. So that's kind of the time where like you can look at it kind of starting for the first time.
Okay, so now we're back to nature nurture again, because during adolescence, I guess things like bullying might become more common and popularity might become more important. But then there's like the whole biological side, like all these hormones and could we talk about how much of that, how much of these mental health problems emerging in adolescence, how much of that is due to biological factors versus environmental factors?
Yeah, I think that's the $1 million question. I think that's what a lot of researchers are interested in. And I think like everything, it comes down to a combination of both. So there's a lot of research looking, for example, at puberty, because one of the starting process of adolescence is the onset of puberty and the release of sex hormones. And we know that those kind of sculpt and change the brain. They might make it more plastic. They might lead to different kind of developmental pathways for girls and boys and lead to some of the sex differences we see in brain function and risk for different mental health problems. So there's probably a strong role for those biological influences and your genes as well, which are going to influence puberty and hormones in the brain. But then at the same time, like you mentioned, there's just so much that starts during adolescence with peer relationships, with dating, with trying to seek more independence from parents and maybe negotiating more parent-child conflict, with being out in the community more and possibly being exposed to risks in the community like neighborhood violence, with academic competition and that having to start to think about college and identity exploration. And so there's kind of so much going on that there's probably a strong environmental component as well. And those two probably interact. So, many teens are exposed to these stressors and are just fine. You know, they are what we call resilient. So they are exposed to stressors, but they don't develop mental health problems. They do well in school. You know, they seem to be functioning really well. And other teens are exposed to these stressors and are not resilient. They develop mental health problems. They develop depression or anxiety, and it can hurt their functioning. And so that's the big question we're looking at is, especially, can we identify biological factors that help explain why two teens who are experiencing the same types of stress are responding so differently to it?
Mm-hmm. This would be a good place to talk about epigenetics, because I think most people tend to think of genetics as like, you know, it's in your DNA and it's like this set things, and then we talk about gene environment interactions, but it's less obvious to me how that happens. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, yeah. So with epigenetics, what that's referring to are kind of essentially like translates to changes on top of the gene. So you're right. Our genetic sequence doesn't change throughout our life. You're born with your genetic sequence and that's what it is throughout your life. But the idea is that these changes on top of your genes can occur throughout your life and do occur. And most of the changes that occur, like one of the main things they do is turn on or off genes. So this is a big component of development, is across development, different genes are turned on or off depending on your developmental stage and what needs to happen. So if you're entering adolescence and you're entering puberty, genes are going to be turned on or off to kind of regulate that process. And that's through epigenetics. But what research is showing is that, so, you know, that's a, like, that's a normal process that like explains a lot of that, you know, contributes to developmental changes. But research is showing that other factors like diet and stress and a range of different kind of lifestyle factors, air pollution, that these can lead to epigenetic changes as well. So the thinking is that that's one way that stress might actually, you know, get under your skin or alter your biology is by influencing these epigenetic markers, which could then turn genes on or off or lead them to be expressed more or less. And maybe that would make your brain more sensitive to threat if you're, you know, activating genes that influence the stress response. So that's kind of the thinking with epigenetics, is it's one way your environment could actually potentially influence your biology.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sort of wondering about this from an evolutionary perspective again, because it there are certain things like depression that come up and that are obviously harmful, but it doesn't seem like they're coming out of nowhere. Like, are there any hidden benefits to these stress responses that we just don't realize?
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably a lot of the mental health problems we see probably have some benefit. Otherwise, they wouldn't, you know, be perpetuated in the population. I think anxiety is a really obvious and easy one, which is that it clearly has a survival benefit, right? Like if you're anxious about the saber-toothed tiger and you detect that early and you run away or fight that off, like you're the one that survives. The person who doesn't have any anxiety and who just walks around the forest, like not worried about anything and gets, you know, killed by the saber-toothed tiger, that they're not going to survive to pass on their genes. So anxiety is, I think, really interesting to me because it actually has a very clear survival benefit. And I think that's why I've been interested in it, is that understanding like, why do we see this range in anxiety? Like, why are some people very high in anxiety and others have almost, you know, no anxiety or imperceptible anxiety? And what's like the right range of anxiety we should be in? Because I don't think the answer is we should have no anxiety. I think anxiety is a clear benefit. So there's maybe a potential ideal range that you should be in where you're kind of detecting things that are important to detect and dealing with those threats, but you're not responding to every like small stressor in the environment. Some of the things I've read from like an evolutionary perspective on depression are that one idea is that it can just kind of, because depression involves lack of motivation, it could help in preventing you from pursuing a goal that's obviously not going to work out. So prevent you from putting in all these resources towards pursuing something that you've received signals is not going to pay off. So if you just kind of save up your, you know, resources and don't go for that thing, you know, then you'll have those for another day. There's also a lot of research linking depression possibly to higher inflammation and the sickness response, and the benefit of not being motivated and staying socially isolated and not going out when you're sick is that you won't expose other people. So there's some benefit there that if there's, you know, if you're actually sick, staying at home and not being motivated and feeling fatigued is beneficial to other people by not exposing them and getting them sick. So there's thought to be maybe this connection between physical health and depression as well.
Uh-huh, that's really interesting. Yeah. So in a way they're kind of the opposite, because anxiety has you like hyper anxious and then depression just has you all unmotivated, but they commonly co-occur, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yeah. And I think they have clear differences. I think the big one is the lack of motivation and depression, which we don't really see as much in anxiety. The similarities I think are in the heightened negative affect, we call our negative emotions. So in both anxiety and depression, you tend to have heightened negative mood, like heightened anxiety. So often you'll hear, even for people who are depressed, like even if they lack motivation, they're still anxious. So, you know, they might still be anxious even if they're not motivated. Increased irritability, increased feelings of guilt, you'll hear in both anxiety and depression. Sometimes increased anger, depending on the individual and kind of what emotions they're experiencing. So that's kind of a common theme between the two, is that these heightened negative emotions. And then we think, again, one thing that differentiates them is with depression, you're also getting this lack of motivation and anhedonia, which is difficulty experiencing pleasure from things that are enjoyable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how does that that influence long-term development? Like, it becomes more common in adolescence, and then does it like hinder future success, whether that's academic or on the job market or things like that?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about both anxiety and depression is they tend to be cyclical. So often they will respond either to treatment, or sometimes they'll just go away on their own. But then they'll pop up again later on, and they're often triggered by stress. So we do know that once you've had one depressive episode, or once you've developed an anxiety disorder, you're at higher risk for developing more of those problems in the future. So what's nice is they do respond to treatments, although not always. But then that does seem to increase your risk later on. So I think part of the idea is finding a treatment that works for that individual and making sure that they have access to that if they need that extra support, or if there's a cycle and it comes back, so that they don't have long periods of time where it's going untreated. And there, again, are lots of individuals who are resilient and find an effective treatment and live a really fulfilled, happy life. And then there are others who don't get that access to treatment, and then it can become kind of this chronic long-term problem.
Uh-huh. So on the societal level, we were wondering, like, how much of the increase in depression is due to people being more aware and open about it, and how much is like actual increase. Mm-hmm. And then when you're talking about individuals who experience one depressive episode more likely to happen again, are they like genuinely more likely, or is it just maybe that those people are also more likely to then be open about it the next time it happens, as opposed to someone who just might always keep it a secret?
I think, yeah, it's probably a combination of the two. So I think if you've already kind of, been open about seeking treatment, or even enrolling in a research study where they're recruiting depressed people, you're probably more likely to continue being open or identifying those symptoms. So it's possibly a little bit of that. But I do believe that there probably is this true effect of, if you've had one depressive episode, you are at higher risk. And again, that's probably just due to the fact that a lot of these risk factors continue on. So mm-hmm. if there are genetic risk factors for anxiety or depression, you'll likely have those, throughout your life. And if you're experiencing stressors, those, depending on the type of stressor, may or may not come back. So I think what's unclear is it the depressive episode itself creates a risk, or it just reoccurs because the same risks, continue throughout your life. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So then you need some type of intervention studies, because first you have to identify the risk, and then you see, like, maybe if we switch this one on or off, do things change?
Yeah. And that's a great way to study it. I think we just need more interventions like that, where you can kind of, especially like for stress, address these things. I think the issue is it's harder to address some of these societal stressors, right? So you can do an intervention and change somebody's thinking patterns. It's a lot harder to intervene on like poverty, or, right, housing affordability, or, rejection even, because that's something the person themselves might not have a lot of control over if they're being rejected by others. So I think that's the challenge, is how do we intervene on these, broad stressors to test their effects.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So all of this came out of talking about your study in Brazil, looking at mm-hmm. depression. And you mentioned there's another line of research you're also working on.
Yeah. So that is my study. We, fairly recently wrapped up data collection on that. So we're working on data analyses, and we have a couple of papers published from that so far. And that is we recruited a sample of adolescents, teens from my area around UC Davis. And we did a neuroimaging study where they did a number of MRI tasks. We also did resting state, where we're just looking at kind of the natural connections in the brain while you're not doing anything. And we looked at different stressors. So I mentioned we measured, bullying and different forms of stress. I think one of the interesting new components we added that I grew increasingly interested in and wanted to, explore when I became an assistant professor, is we looked at inflammation as well. And so I kind of mentioned inflammation briefly before, but there's been in research this connection between inflammation and depression. Uh-huh. And I grew interested in it because I actually was really interested in understanding how different lifestyle factors influence risk for depression. So I was kind of fascinated by learning that things like diet could influence depression, because you think like, well, mm-hmm. how do the foods that I eat, impact my depression or anxiety? And exercise and kind of all of these different lifestyle factors. And so I grew interested in looking at inflammation because it's one potential pathway. So we know that, What?
How do you measure inflammation and where?
Inflammation, good question. Yeah. So inflammation is the body's response to fighting off viruses or bacteria, or if you get injured, inflammation helps kind of heal that injury. So it's typically a good thing. So we need inflammation to, you know, help fight off bacteria and viruses. It's kind of a cascade of different chemicals and proteins and signals that help your body respond to these kind of physical kind of illnesses. But what research is showing is that there are certain lifestyle factors that lead to chronic inflammation. And so inflammation that doesn't, you know, isn't due to being sick, but is just kind of always there. And we measure that with some of the inflammatory markers that are part of the inflammation or the immune response. So in my study, we collected blood samples from the adolescents, from like, just a standard blood draw like you do at the doctors. And we looked at different inflammatory markers. So some examples are C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha. So these are just chemicals that are part of that inflammation response. And the amount that we see tells us, you know, how much inflammation is present. And so lifestyle factors, like I mentioned, like diet, physical activity, sleep, are also linked to inflammation and these inflammatory markers. So even if you're not sick, there's evidence that if you're overweight or if you eat a diet kind of that's the American fast food diet, like high calorie, high fat, if you don't get a lot of physical activity, if you get poor sleep, all of these things can lead to this higher inflammation. And it's not due to fighting off a bacteria or a virus, it's just due to those lifestyle factors. So that's how we measure that in my study.
Right. And then it seems like it's bi-directional too, because maybe a bad diet increases your depression, but then if you're depressed, it's like you're not that motivated to eat healthy or to go out and exercise.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So so there are these bi-directional connections between our body and our brain. So there's evidence that if you have higher inflammation in your body, there are pathways through which it can reach your brain. Typically, the blood-brain barrier protects, you know, your brain from stuff that's going on in your body, but these inflammatory markers can reach your brain through a couple of different routes. But on top of that, so the inflammatory markers can influence your brain. But research has also shown that when you get stressed out and your brain reacts to stress, it can lead to the release of these inflammatory markers in your body. So it can go like both ways, where the signals can go up to your brain and your brain can signal your body, and it can potentially even like kind of loop like that.
Yeah. So how do you break those loops?
So that would be like an intervention study, which I don't actually research intervention. So in our study, we're just looking at kind of the correlations or associations between these immune markers and the brain. But I think, you know, the obvious way would be to change the lifestyle factors and see if that changes. That would be one way to break the loop in terms of changing the inflammation in your body. So again, exercise is great for reducing inflammation. So that would be a great option for an intervention study for somebody wanted to study that. Changing your diet, it can also reduce inflammation. Getting better sleep. So one of my collaborators I talked to, I remember him saying something like, you know, if you want to like raise somebody's inflammatory markers like really quickly over the course of a day, just have them not get a good night's sleep. So not getting a good night's sleep or being sleep deprived increases those inflammatory markers. So if you can get better sleep, go to bed earlier, that can lower them. And that's also another problem for teens. Speaking of like societal contributions to depression, another big push for teens is getting later school start times, because teens' biological sleep clocks are delayed or much later compared to adults. So they have a tendency to want to stay up later, but sleep in later. And then when you have a high school start time at like 7 a.m. and they're having to wake up, you know, at 6 a.m. to get to school by 7 a.m., you're really cutting short their sleep cycle, because biologically they should be sleeping much later than that. So that's another factor that could influence inflammation too.
So it seems like it's often easier to not to say, here's what you should do to improve things, but like, here's what you shouldn't do. Here's what we know makes
something
worse.
I mean, there's a lot you could do. I think, like I said, exercise is one. I think incorporating, you know, certain things into your diet, like fruits and vegetables and healthy fats are things you should or could do. And again, getting a good night's sleep and finding ways to get better sleep, like relaxing before bed, not looking at screens an hour before bed. There's a lot you could, like positive things you could do, I think, that could have an impact. And then I think, like I said, the next step would be to do an intervention study and see if you intervene on one or more of these things. Does that lower inflammation? And then does that in turn change the brain or, you know, your risk for depression or anxiety through that?
So one other big thing we haven't talked about is sex differences in any of these relationships. Have you looked at that at all?
We have looked at that a little bit. Most of my studies, at least the ones we're doing now, are just not large enough to really have the sample size to look at sex differences. Because anytime you're looking at sex differences, you're splitting your sample size in half. And so a lot of my studies right now have like 100 or 150 participants, and that's not really big enough to look at sex differences. But we do have a grant. This is the one I'm a co-investigator on with the ABCD study, where we're going to look at kind of puberty and influences on the brain, and then obviously sex differences, because puberty has different effects in boys and girls. So I think that kind of sex difference question is well suited to the ABCD study, where you have thousands of participants and you can, you know, split them into male and female and still have like a massive sample size to analyze. So that will be coming up in our analyses. Yeah.
That's good. Cause I was going to ask you next about your future plans for research, but that answers one big avenue. And then you also mentioned that the Brazil study, you're turning it into a longitudinal study. So that's also up and coming.
Right. Yeah. So we're following them up now. And one thing we're just interested in is, was our risk score prediction accurate? So, you know, we kind of classified them when they were on average 15 years old. They're between 14 to 16. We're following them up now, and I think they're about 18 years old now. So a big question is like, how did our risk score perform? Did the people, you know, we say were at higher risk, did they develop depression or not? Could we maybe use this in a public health kind of setting to, you know, to classify risk and get people treatments earlier on? And then from my perspective or my contribution, we're also looking at the brain and how did these risk classifications predict changes in the brain? Did we see different changes in the brain for the adolescents who did go on to develop depression versus those who did not? Can that help us explain, you know, why someone's at higher risk compared to someone else? So those are all kind of questions we're excited to look at with this new.
Yeah. So this would be a good place to kind of talk about either the philosophical or the practical implications. Let's imagine your risk factors, what you predicted, comes out to be 100% correct. What would that tell us? What would the next steps be to do something about that?
Well, first of all, I don't think they'll ever be 100% correct. I think the one thing I've learned kind of doing this over time is everything is probabilistic in psychology. So I don't think I've ever read about an effect where, you know, it happened 100% of the time for all individuals, or a perfect correlation where, you know, this variable was perfectly correlated with this one. There's a huge amount of variation. Yeah. So I think that's the main lesson I've taken away from, you know, being in the field is we can predict things to some extent, but there's a huge amount of like probability and chance and random events and noise and, you know, chaos in the system that we'll probably never get to perfect prediction. But I think if we got to good prediction, then I think that could have, you know, benefits for better screening. So I think one of the problems is we don't have great tools to screen for risk for depression. And so the people who are at higher risk do not always get access to preventions or interventions that could help. So I think having a quick screening tool that's just 11 yes or no questions that is pretty easy to administer could have kind of major public health benefits in that way. The same way we screen for other things like diabetes risk. And then we tell people, you're at high risk for diabetes. You should, you know, start making these changes in your life to lower your risk. So we don't have those types of screening tools yet for depression, but I think that could be one benefit. My collaborator, Christian Keeling, often likens it to the Framingham risk score for heart disease. And that's a tool that's used medically. And it's a kind of questionnaire where it asks you about your weight and different lifestyle factors. Do you smoke? And then you get your risk for heart disease. So kind of using it in a similar way, but for mental health.
So the idea would be to identify all of those risk factors and then point towards specific areas of improvement for any given adolescent.
Yeah, and I think a future direction the group is heading in, we haven't kind of gotten there yet, but is now kind of maybe testing interventions or treatments. So mm-hmm. now that we've identified risk and maybe identified the brain circuits or the psychological processes tied to this risk, could we then use that information to develop an intervention that would, you know, maybe prevent the development of depression or treat it more quickly or more effectively? Then it might get treated without this kind of risk status approach.
Uh-huh. So I could imagine a similar study being done, looking at risk factors and looking at depression, and then completely without the brain scans. So what does that add to the picture?
Well, I think as I mentioned, one of the things I'm really interested in that I think the brain scans can help with is that kind of increasing our predictive power. So no matter, again, what risk factor you look at, I think all the ones I can think of, there's a lot of people who are exposed to that risk factor and never develop depression or anxiety. And so the big question is, well, why didn't they? Like, they were exposed to this, you know, risk factor, and we know that it's a huge risk factor for depression. So what, you know, what was the difference there? Or why did that other person who was exposed to the risk factor, why did they develop depression? And I think the brain data can kind of help answer that and give us one point of data. It's not going to answer all of it, but it could help us understand differences in the brain and the way people process information that comes in from their environments, how they process rejection and threat and stress, and help us understand why two people who experience the same exact stressor respond really differently. And then with that knowledge of the differences in brain processing, maybe target different interventions or therapies. If we're like, okay, this is really tied to this reward circuit in the brain. So a therapy that, you know, really focuses on positive reward and positive affect might be best suited for people who have this risk factor or, you know, in this population. So just kind of helping us understand how to better tailor those preventions or treatments, because right now we just don't have we have these broad risk factors, but we don't have a lot of precision with them. Uh-huh.
So do you think one day it might be part of your regular doctor's checkup to get a brain scan?
No. So I actually don't. Not in the near future. I think if MRI scans get like, I think if there's a change in the technology, the way we saw a change with smartphones. So I guess if you'd asked me a while ago, like, do you think you'll have like the internet at like in your hand at all times and you can just look up anything you want anytime, I would have been like, well, that sounds like very science fiction. So I guess I wouldn't say like a firm no. I would say if the MRI technology became less expensive and less kind of taking up space and less of a requirement, like for there to be this like, you know, room that's blocked off that people can't walk in if they have any like a pacemaker or anything. I mean, it just takes up a lot of space and it's an expensive piece of equipment and it's expensive to run a scan. So right now, just the cost of it and the space and the difficulty, for example, reaching rural populations, I think prevents it from being used in that kind of day-to-day basis. I think if one day we invent like a brain scanning system that you could just like put on your head and it's a cap or something, I could see that being used. So I think it's more, the way I see it being used more is more just, again, like understanding these brain circuits and then saying like, oh, okay, like that's the difference in how the brain is processing this information. Now that we know that that's how that risk factor works, or that's how, you know, that's the brain process tied to these symptoms. For people who have these symptoms, we know that doing this behavioral intervention or, you know, this computer task that retrains the brain or whatever it is could be more effective for them. So getting away from the kind of current approach of just trial and error, well, try this antidepressant, that didn't work, try this one, you know, try this treatment, that didn't work, try this one, which is a little bit kind of the way things go, is it's a lot of trial and error. So just kind of reducing that and again, getting more precision there.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to stop.
Great.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, thank you for having me.